I have a dream. Some of you will perhaps remember that great address by Martin Luther King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial Building in Washington in 1963. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they are not judged by the colour of their skin, but by the content of their character. Gandhi echoed the same sentiments when he said, "All men are brothers. So whatever our national or cultural identity, we are the same origin. We have the same dignity. We belong in the same world." Surely, I thought, these great truths would undercut all human divisiveness based on nationality, culture, and race. That's what I thought as a young man. And I felt it very strongly. I was idealistic until my parents sent me on a French exchange. And what I say now has no connection at all in my subconscious to the fact that we played rugby against them yesterday. But when I went on the French exchange, I discovered one objective truth. The French are a very odd lot. That's what I found. For example, shouting at them in the Queen's English does not actually help communication. It gave a whole new word to the phrase misunderstanding. The only word they ever really understood that I said was Coca-Cola, with the fact that they bought me so much I was burping throughout the whole holiday. And that is why Genesis 11 verse 1 has always been very precious to me. If we look down, for here we read that there was once a day, Genesis 11 verse 1, now the whole world had one language and a common speech. Here we read that there was once a day when everybody spoke in English. Isn't that wonderful? Actually, the smiling must stop there because the first 11 Genesis are no laughing matter. They tell a desperate story. The clue is in verse 2 if we look down. Here's the clue. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. And the clue is that word eastward. Eastward is never a good direction to be going in Genesis. Theologically, it is to go away from the Garden of Eden, away from our loving Creator. So the message is that things are still going wrong in chapter 11. And really the message so far couldn't be worse. In 1 to 3, it's God's world and he rules it by in accordance with his character. But Adam and Eve want their own world and their own rules. So they basically say to God, they say, "Listen, God, give us your things, but we don't want you. We want your things, but we don't want you, and we don't want your law." And the result in Genesis 3, as we know, is they lose paradise. So we have those haunting words in chapter 3, verse 24. They were driven out of the garden east. You see, they're going east, east of Eden. Not only is their intimate fellowship with God lost, but there is then massive social breakdown in chapter 4, culminating with the fact that Cain and Lamech become murderers. And so the evil spreads across the world, and with it, the judgment. And then we hit the catastrophe of the flood. But that is not actually the whole story, because along with God's judgment, we also, as we see without Scripture, we see his mercy. Throughout Scripture, we see his mercy. So in chapter 3, in the midst of the fall, what is there? There is the promise of a deliverer. One day a deliverer will come. I wonder who could that be? But a deliverer is promised. In chapter 7, in the midst of the flood, there is Noah's Ark of Mercy, in which 8 people are spared. So on the very tides of God's wrath, yet there is mercy. And now in chapter 11, amid another portrait of God's judgment, there will nevertheless also be mercy as we look down. So what is God so angry about now as we see the judgment continuing? What's he angry about? Verses 1 to 4, if we can look down. And the title for this, the heading is Man's Rebellion. That is where his anger lies, in man's rebellion, verses 1 to 4. And the rebellion is being plotted, particularly in verse 3, if we can look down. So here we have the minutes of a planning meeting, if you like. If we look down verse 3, they said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used bricks instead of stone and bitumen for mortar. Verse 4, then they said, "Come, let's build ourselves a city." Now the bland English here, "come, let's make bricks and come, let's build ourselves a city," actually hides the sense of enthusiasm and animated zeal in the original Hebrew. A better reading would be, "Come on, come on, go for it, go for it. Let's make bricks, let's make a city." These participants are describing the plans excitedly to each other, as though this is the ultimate life achievement that they're now going to build. This is going to be the great work. And these words are all about anticipation. There's great anticipation here. It will re-energize the nation, raise the self-esteem of its people, and enhance the nation's standing. That's how Tony Blair described the building of the Millennium Dome 2 years ago. And these verses have that same sense of anticipation. It's here. So in verse 3, as we look down, they decide to bake bricks rather than use natural stones. These bricks will be strengthened by, verse 3, if we look down, burning. Not just bricks of clay dried in the sun, because they're going to put all their strength and energy into building something that's really going to last. That's the intention. And the materials you see, bricks instead of mortar, bitumen, that's a sort of combination of burnt clay and slime, bitumen instead of mortar, are part of the rebellion because they are man-made. That's what we're being taught in verse 3. You see, they're saying, we don't need your stones, God. We'll make our own bricks. And now we see the heart of their agenda in verse 4 as the rebellion continues. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Well, I mean, let's pause for a moment. I mean, what's wrong with wanting to make a name for yourself? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with wanting to stick together? I guess the boardrooms and common rooms and committee rooms of this country are full of the language of verse 4, aren't they? I mean, you know, united we stand, divided we fall. This is our time. This is our time to make a mark. Very, very few have got the opportunity that lies before us today. We must seize it because you've only got one life. What's wrong with that? Doesn't seem too bad. We can relate to it. It's fine, isn't it? But here's the issue. Genesis sees their reasons for building as a mark of their rebellion against God. Do you see verse 4, if we look down? They want a tower that reaches for the heavens. Genesis spent a lot of time making it clear to us that heaven is God's home, not ours. Heaven is his home. God has put us under the earth. He's put us here under the, he's put us on earth under the heavens to rule over the earth, under his authority. And reaching for the heavens in this context means they are rejecting God's rule over them. That's what they're doing. They're putting themselves or seeking to put themselves in God's place. They are dethroning him, replacing him with their own authority. So what have we got here? This is the first declaration of humanism. Let's not think humanism was concocted in the 18th century. It wasn't. This is the first declaration of humanism. They're saying, we are going to go it alone without God. That is what we will do with our lives. We will go it alone and we will not make reference to God. We will reach for the heavens ourselves. Again, verse 4, if we look down, they want to make a name for themselves. And that sounds fair enough, doesn't it? I mean, who doesn't want to make a name for themselves? I love the story of the Egyptian architect Nidus, who was commissioned by one of the pharaohs to build a lighthouse at the mouth of the river Nile. Well, he did that, and in bold characters on the outside of the lighthouse, he engraved the pharaoh's name, Ptolemy, across it. And for everybody to see, but as the decades passed, the wind and the rain gradually did their work, eroding the outer covering of the lighthouse, and eventually the name of the pharaoh disappeared completely. And it was then discovered that Nidus had engraved his own name in the masonry beneath the outer covering. So in the end, 100 years later, all people could see was the name Nidus. That's pretty harmless, isn't it? I think that's actually quite cool. I rather respect him for that. But sadly, that's not the whole story here. What these people are actually doing is trying to rival God's reputation. Again, Genesis has made it quite clear to us that God is our creator and we're his creatures. And in Genesis chapter 2, here's the issue. Naming. Do you remember the naming that goes on in the garden? Naming is a function of God's authority. It's a function of authority. It's a sign of dominion, of dominance. So do you remember? God named Adam, and Adam named the animals. And therefore, here, with this city and this tower, when they want to name themselves, when they want to obtain a name, they're saying, we're tired of being dominated by you, God. We're tired of being a subsidiary to you, to our Creator. We'll make our own name. We will take our own authority on board. And we will have our own power and our own independence. And they do it in a way that's far less subtle than Nidus. They're just going to go for it. They will take authority. And this at root is what the Bible means by the term the world. Right through the Bible, again and again, that term, the world, will emerge. And it's the desire to exclude God from his creation. And that's what unites people in opposition to God. They want to shut God out and go it alone. And of course, it was right at the heart of so much that went on in the last century, in the 20th century. Yuri Gagarin. Do you remember Yuri Gagarin, the first cosmonaut? What did he say when he came back to Earth? He said, "I didn't see God up there." Do you remember that? "I didn't see God out there." And that's the philosophy of atheistic materialism. Shutting God out. Let's shut God out of his world. Let's say there's no God. Let's base our philosophical and economic and political theories on the assumption that God does not exist. So again, it was Nietzsche who wrote, "God is dead. We have killed him. And the stench is all over Europe." There it is. And it's the declaration of humanism. So man will construct, man will make his own environment, man will find a security and a unity apart from God, and it is all as old as the Tower of Babel. I was very struck by the cover story of the Sunday Times culture section. I don't know why they call it the culture section, I always just get it for the telly, but anyway, the Sunday Times culture section. And in here, Brian Appleyard reports on an exhibition that is soon to begin in the National Gallery, and this is what he writes. It's entitled "The True Face of Art," and he says this: "Christianity may be uncool in this secular age, but it remains the bedrock of Western culture. Western art was Christian and is Christian. Believers or not, we cannot evade the gospel's continuing presence in our culture. Their meanings, their imagery, have determined the way we think, the way we create." And then he writes this: "This is why the Millennium Dome is empty in every sense, because it is an embarrassed denial of this truth. The National Gallery will soon be full in every sense, because it is about to celebrate 2,000 years of Christian art." So the dome has absolutely failed to acknowledge the truth that is right at the heart of this passage and indeed the Bible. What's the truth? Perhaps if you can take your service sheets, we can see it. We prayed it earlier. Our Father in heaven, here's the truth that the dome absolutely fails to acknowledge. Here it is. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done. That's the truth there. And the dome is empty of that truth. So was Babel. Babel and the dome would celebrate Swinburne's famous words, these words: "Glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of all things." Do you see what's going on here? What's being exposed here? But the Bible tells us that God's name, his name, is to be our top priority, not our own. And here's the key. I wonder if you live by this. It's so hard. I've been so convicted by this. Here's the key. My name and my reputation is ultimately in God's hands, not in my hands. It's in his hands. And the great danger for Christians is to be more concerned with what people think of us than what they think of him. That's the danger. More concerned with making a name for ourselves, in our office, in our families perhaps, among our friends, than in making a name for him. This came home to me very starkly about 4 years ago. I was speaking to a man, and I was telling him about some carol services he could invite office friends to. And he suddenly said to me, look, I couldn't possibly invite anyone from my office to the carol services. It's a Jewish firm, and that would threaten my career. I couldn't possibly do it. Do you see the issue? More concerned with his own name, his own career, than with God's. And the desire for reputation, the desire for fame, perhaps even a craving for publicity, is an urge that goes very deep in many of us. Even those of us who on one level relish anonymity, on another we want to be noticed. We do. It's a very basic instinct. We don't like to feel insignificant. This is especially true of clergy.
I confess I'm haunted by the words a 6-year-old, mature, godly Christian woman said to me, having heard me give a talk when I was 23. I thought it was a very fine talk. She said, very gently afterwards, she said, "Rico, do you know you can always tell whether the preacher is concerned with his own reputation or with God's?" Very striking. Another older Christian prayed for me before I went on a mission. I was leading a mission. He said, "Please give them only as many converts as their pride will allow." And as I remember, there weren't many professions of faith on that mission. So can I ask you, as I ask myself, I mean really deep down here, can I ask you, whose name are you really concerned for? Whose name? Actually, is your life about your reputation or God's? Do you actually pray the Lord's Prayer with your whole heart? Hallowed be your name. Well, let me help you diagnose this so that we can just work out exactly what's going on. What do you daydream about? Where are your daydreams? What are your constant daydreams? Because that reveals where your heart is, and that reveals what you're concerned with. Are you concerned with God's name, God's reputation, or are you building your own tower, building your own name? Do you know, in this country, 2,000 people leave the church a month, and most of them are under 50. Now, there is something to daydream about. What is that saying about God's name in this land? That's something to daydream about. Now, to help us focus off our reputation, our name, actually fundamentally off our own pride, Michael Ramsay, the ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, gave some very good advice. He made three recommendations. Recommendation number one, if you're finding that actually your life is all about your own name, not God's, number one is confession. Are we daily confessing our sin? So we read the Bible, and it shows us what we're really like, and we're confessing and acknowledging that actually so often we're about building our own names, not God's. So number one, how's your confession going? Secondly, thanksgiving. I knew a very godly clergyman who kneeled by his bed every night and every morning and just gave thanks. But thanksgiving, so acknowledging that any abilities we might have are from God. So again, we refocus where we're building. And Ramsay writes in his book, he said, confession and thanksgiving are soil in which pride does not easily grow. Thirdly, interestingly, Ramsay actually says that we are to cultivate friends who will laugh at us. Do you have friends who will laugh at you? Who, as the British say, will pull your leg? So actually they stop taking you too seriously? Well, the Archbishop recommends that you do. Otherwise, you'll be building your own name, your own tower, and you won't have people who can gently put their hand on your shoulder. So three great tools: confession, thanksgiving, and friends. Then if we go back to verse 4, he says again that they want to remain together. Do you see that end of verse 4? So that we may not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. And again, that sounds fine. It's natural to want to stick together. But if we look back in Genesis, in chapter 9, verse 1, God has told them to spread out and fill the earth and subdue it. And they knew what God had said, they knew, but they decided here at Babel that they knew better. And they replaced what God has said, as we also often do, with their own plans and their own priorities. And that's surely the center of the human tragedy, this rebellion, isn't it? As they do that, it's right at the heart. Verse 4 is the human tragedy. Number 1, we reject God's rule. Come, let's build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens. A rejection of God's rule, I'll reach out for the heavens. Number 2, we make a name for ourselves. We worship ourselves, or seek to. And number 3, we replace God's word, in here Genesis 9 verse 1, with our own plans, our own ideas. It's right at the heart, isn't it, of human rebellion. And that's the nature of man's rebellion. So let's move from that, from man's rebellion, that's the first heading, to verses 5 to 9 as we finish, to God's reaction. So those are our two headings, man's rebellion, 1 to 4, and now we have God's reaction. And please look, if you would, at verse 5. Verse 5. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the men were building. I wonder if you can see the contrast. They thought they were making the most outstanding building ever constructed. Indeed, archaeologists have found the remains of this building in Shinar, verse 2, which is in northern Iraq.
and it was known as a ziggurat, and it was thought to be 300 feet high. They found 33 other ziggurats in 26 other cities, but this was by far the biggest. So in its day, this was the tallest ever freestanding man-made structure. That's how they saw it. But verse 5, if we look down, tells a very different story. You see, the tower was so tiny that God couldn't even see it from where he was sitting. So you see the tower through their eyes, verse 4, stretching up into the heavens. That's how they see it in verse 4, reaching up into the clouds. It's amazing. I'm sure they said, what amazing lifts. Incredible lifts, I'm sure they said. That's verse 4. Verse 5, we then see the tower from God's perspective. And the tallest ever man-made structure is put alongside the power of the great Creator. And in the Hebrew, it's as though God has to get down on all fours, on his hands and knees, before he can clearly see it. As we might, you know, when you're perhaps playing with a toddler and you get down to look at their Lego. That's what God has to do to see this tower. And you see, suddenly we see the futility of their rebellion. It was ridiculous to expect to take on God and win. For what is God like? Isaiah 40. Here's the God that holds the oceans in the palm of his hands. So in the palm of his hand, he holds the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Mediterranean. That's who God is. Here's the God before whom the nations are as a drop of water. Perhaps this morning you cleaned your teeth. If you didn't, that's a filthy habit. You must start cleaning them. But perhaps you cleaned your teeth this morning, and there was some water that just splashed into the sink and down. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And that's what the nations are like before this great God. And it's futile, as they do here, to take on God. Now why? Ultimately, why is it so futile to take on God? Well, actually, Genesis chapter 5 has already dealt with this issue. It's already taught us this. It is futile to take on God because we die. That's why it's futile to take on God, because you and I will die. I hate the thought of this, but the world will one day and quite soon be a Ricotice-free zone. We die. As the Anglican funeral service makes so clear, you know, you stand at the graveside and you say, as for man, his days are like grass, he flourishes like a flower of the field. So we may build our name, we may build our great towers, but ultimately, verse 14, we are like dust. You can hoover us up. We're blown away like freshly mown grass. As for man, his days are like grass, he flourishes like a flower of the field, but its place remembers it no more. Grass just gets blown away and so do we. So the sensible thing to do is to link up with your Creator, for you will not live for long. Verse 17 of that psalm, but from everlasting to everlasting, the Lord's love is with those who fear him. It's madness to take on God in the light of the fact that you and I will die. And as the Lord, verse 5, gets on all fours to see their tower, he exposes their delusions in that verse. But God doesn't only come down to see. In verse 7, he creates confusion. And actually, this land of Shinar becomes known as Babel, Babylon, which in Hebrew means he confused. And indeed, we have the word Babel today, which means confused speech. It's all from here. So verse 7, let's go on. Let's see what happens. Come, let us go down and confuse their languages so that they will not understand each other. Now, actually, in the original language here, there is a parallelism. Verse 3, they literally say, let's make bricks. So the passage here just says, let's mix up bricks. That's what it literally means. The passage here just says, let's make bricks. And here in verse 7, there's an echo of that as God says, let's mix up, confuse their languages. So the mixing of bricks, which they do in verse 3, is matched with the mixing of languages, which God does in verse 7. And then we see the result in verse 8. God scattered them over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. So God puts a stop to the skyscraper, and at the same time puts an end to their life as a community. And he sentences them to permanent frustration in their communication with each other. And what they are afraid of, which verse 4 was being scattered, is exactly what happens to them in verse 8. And again, I mean, this is so striking, isn't it? This is so striking. This is right at the heart of the human tragedy, isn't it? The world that we live in. At the personal level, we experience that frustration in all our relationships. in boardrooms and bedrooms and classrooms and congregations and factories and families and French exchanges. We experience this. Relationships have a tendency to break down. That's what we're being told. We struggle to cooperate and communicate with each other, but we find ourselves saying, "Don't you find, look, I don't think we're talking the same language." That's a constant echo, a constant theme. And Genesis is saying this same principle is true at a global level. So all the internet advertising at the moment may talk about the global village, but the nations will always struggle to understand each other. They will find it hard to cooperate together. And here's the issue. Because God intends them to. For when something else like a tower replaces God as the organizing center of our life, sooner or later we will find it very difficult to get on together. That is the message here. And that's what's extraordinary here, because this is the way God wants it. It's the way he designed it. Let me just say this very clearly so we understand it. Confusion and frustration are God's deliberate intention here. He means us to be confused and frustrated between the nations. And he explains the reason in verse 6. Let's have a look at verse 6. It's very striking. The Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them." Do you know we sometimes say, don't we? We sometimes say that people need saving from themselves. That's exactly here in this article in the Sunday Times, which Gary Lineker, the footballer says about Paul Gascoigne. He writes in this article, "Self-destruction was always something which Paul Gascoigne specialized in." Gascoigne, you see, a great talent, but a man who actually needs to be saved from himself. And most of us are quite capable of following a course of action that can be disastrous. And sometimes we need someone to step in and save us from ourselves. And if that's true of us as individuals, it is certainly also true of us as societies, not least because the first fact in the Bible, Genesis 1 verse 1, is what? What's the first thing we're told in the Bible? That God is the creator. That's the first thing I learned about God, that he's the creator. And what's the first thing I then learn about man? Genesis 1 verse 26, that man is made in the image of God. So if man reflects in his own makeup the image of God the Creator, that means that man is endowed with phenomenal creative potential. Phenomenal creative potential. And of course we know that. The last century taught us that. If it taught us anything, it was that man is endowed with phenomenal creative potential. And it's all in Genesis 1 verse 26. But divorce that creative potential from its roots in God himself, and the scenario is ominous. The scenario is in verse 6. There's the scenario. Let's see what happens when we divorce these two things. Man's creative potential from God, from the God that made man. Nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. And the unrestricted use of creative power divorced from the will of God has enormous potential for destruction. Unbelievable potential for destruction. Like Paul Gascoigne, man does need saving from himself. And what happens, you see, if men get into huge crowds, they are capable of incredible destruction. And they need to be scattered. Just think of those enormous crowds you may have seen, perhaps in the Nuremberg rallies pre-World War II, Hitler's rallies. Those enormous crowds, terrifying, awesome crowds. And what we're being told here is they need to be scattered. They need to be separated. And God in his mercy creates confusion among the nations by restricting our mutual understanding. He scatters us and limits our power for evil. He saves us from ourselves. And of this we can therefore be certain. There will be no utopia this side of the grave. I do hope you're not trying to build heaven on earth, are you? There will be no utopia this side of the grave, whatever the politicians might promise. As so many around us build their towers and set about making a name for themselves. But our job is to be just like Abraham, The man who comes on the scene in verse 27 of chapter 11 and then carries the story forward in chapter 12 of Genesis. Abraham, who in the book of Hebrews, some of you will know, was looking forward to the city whose foundations, whose architect and builder was God. Abraham, who set out from Babylon, from the land of confusion, he left that land and he heads not just to Canaan, but to heaven. So central to the Christian hope is the fact that God has designed for us a city not built by human hands. You see, Babel was built by human hands, not reaching up to the heavens, Genesis 11 verse 4, but actually a city, Revelation 21 verse 2, coming down out of heaven to us. Not a city that we build up, but one that God brings down. And this city is described in Revelation. Do you think about heaven? Are your eyes on heaven? Babel is actually meant to take me to look ahead, so that I look to somewhere better. Heaven will be a place of community in Revelation 21, 22, where the dream of nations living in brotherly love will be a reality. So, as Gandhi says, all men there will indeed be brothers in heaven. Why? Because we'll be without sin and we'll be like Christ. And we will be as brothers. And the trees, we read, will be for the healing of the nations. There will be a day when we'll live in harmony, but it will not be in this life. It'll be a place of intimacy where we see Christ face to face. Let's be honest, it's so hard, isn't it, to keep going sometimes because you cannot see Christ. I wish I could show him to him. I wish I could see him myself. But instead, I have to walk by faith, by trust in this book. I've just got to walk by faith. I can't see him. But there will be a day in heaven when I will see him face to face and he will wipe every tear from our eye. That's an incredibly intimate gesture. And we'll see him face to face. Community, intimacy. Two things Babel terribly lacked. And thirdly, security. They wanted to build security, but they were scattered. But heaven will not be like that. I'm sure you find this when you first came to London. You arrived in London and you made a tiny little place. Maybe it was just a little bedsit or a small room. You made it your own. That was where you were. That was your base. Security. It was where you belonged. And in heaven there'll be security where we belong. And indeed it will be a place, lastly, of perfection. A place of overwhelming beauty. Community, intimacy, security, perfection. So, question, do you have a passport to that city? Do you know you're going there? You see, are you sure, as we read in Revelation 21, that you are in the Lamb's Book of Life? Are you certain of your passport? There may be some here who are not certain of their passport. And if you're not, then come to Christianity Explained, 7 o'clock, Wednesday evening, and we can talk about that. That's what we're dealing at that week, so that we can fix our eyes on heaven. Secondly, as we continue, one, have you got a passport? If you know you have, if you're a Christian here tonight, what are you doing with your life? Are you building your own name, your own tower, or are you concerned, as we read in the Lord's Prayer, with God's name? Hand on heart, where are your daydreams? Where are your real concerns? Where are your resources going? For example, with World Need next week, with World Mission next week. What are you concerned with? Your own name, your own tower, or with God's? Where is your concern? The glory of your name or Christ's? Only one life to live. It will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ. Only that will last. Striking, isn't it? Only one life to live, it'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ, only that will last.